number five. Makita LeBlanc versus the Great Western Express. Can you wait a minute till she's getting organized over there? All right, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Frank Stafford and I represent the appellants in this case. This is an appeal to the Seventh Circuit based upon the failure of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana to tender an instruction, or basically a verdict form, to the jury listing 11 non-party that we had named in this case. This was a multi-chain motor vehicular accident. And under Indiana law, we used as one of our affirmative defenses 11 non-parties. When the case came to closure, we requested
the... ask why this matters? The district court did tender a consolidated form, and the jury apparently allocated 40% of the fault to the people who were piled up in front of the LeBlanc car. And why does it make any difference, so far as this case is concerned, that they didn't do it 2% to X and 3% to Y, and just said 40% to the 11 of them as a group?
In response, Your Honor, the statute in Indiana specifically requires the court that the court shall...
I'm not asking why you think it was erroneous. I'm asking why you think the error, if any, matters.
For the reason that the defendant had offered an instruction that any stopping or stopping on the roadway may have been a cause for this accident. The plaintiff in this case also stopped. We have no knowledge as to whether or not that jury was confused when they didn't have a form listing the 11 non-parties for the allocation of fault in this case.
I still don't understand why this isn't the paradigm of harmless error.
Well, I believe it is harmless error. I don't believe it's harmless error, Your Honor. I think it's error to the defendant. I think our rights were prejudiced.
But can you explain how?
Well, I think that the jury should have been able to allocate fault to the individual non-parties that were listed in that case. The failure...
Why does it matter, unless we have some reason to believe that the total amount they would have allocated among the 11 was greater than 40% if they had done it one by one, how is there any consequence?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor, because I don't know what... the jury. I can't put myself in that jury box to try to understand what that jury thought or did not thought.
Weren't the defenses all the same for all 11? This was a pile of right. If you can't tell us, you know, what impact you think it had on the verdict, are there any facts that were suggested by breaking it up? There was enough of a difference between each of the defendants that somehow you can argue prejudice.
I think each of the non-parties played a different role. The non-parties, Your Honor, in this case, each played a different role in this case. I think some of them had more susceptibility as to causation. We're not talking about the injury to the plaintiff. We're talking about causation. We think some of those non-parties had a greater percentage of fault than some of the others. That's the reason the Indiana comparative fault allows us to list the non-parties as an affirmative defense. The court, in his comments when we were arguing the instructions, stated that he thought that to give this would be confusing and confuse the evidence to the jury. Well, I think the facts of the case go to the jury. If the court did not want to allow me to have my 11 non-parties as an affirmative defense, then maybe the court should have stricken it. But the court allowed me to make that argument. But the jury didn't know when they go back to deliberate who the 11 non-parties are. They may have been discussed during the course of the trial, but they weren't identified by a verdict form. And that, I can't
look. But didn't you repeatedly tell the district court that you didn't have any, that you were not going to propose such a form? It was only at the last minute you switched positions?
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor. I did tell the U.S. District Court. I asked the district court for his assistance. In Indiana, if you submit an instruction where you name a non-party, it almost consists of an entire 8.5 by 11 page because there's a formula you follow. I asked the court for assistance because if you name 11 non-parties who each are distinct from each other, the verdict form would have been in excess of 11 pages. I then requested the court for its assistance in tendering the instruction. And then if you go to the Indiana Code, if I go back to the other justice, the Indiana Code says the court shall give an instruction listing those non-parties, and that was not done. So I think my substantial rights on behalf of my client were prejudiced in this case. I think the recent case also that came down, the Scholes case, Indiana has adopted the word shall as presumptively mandatory. The Indiana Code, the court shall furnish the jury with the verdict form listing the non-parties. We believe that there. We believe the court erred in failing to tender that instruction. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if there's no other questions.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Karen Neiswinger for the appellee.
Proceed, please.
In this case, if you take a look at page, I believe it is 344 of Appellee's appendix, this is volume 10, page 1631 of the transcript, the district judge offered to Mr. Saffron to append to instruction number 28 the list of the names of all the non-parties. And if you backtrack from that slightly, first of all, the final pretrial order required parties to tender proposed instructions. He failed to tender a proposed instruction listing the 11 non-parties. Federal law does control the issue of whether or not to give instructions. And if you take a look at the two cases we cited, one is...
I don't understand that.
Pardon me?
This is a diversity case.
Well...
The applicable law is provided by the state.
The substantive law does, but whether or not the grant or denial of instructions is controlled by federal law, because it is procedure, not substance. So under the local rule and also Rule 16 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the pretrial order controlled and it required him to tender proposed instruction. He didn't do it. And case law, the Lancaster versus Norfolk and Western Railway case and Chase versus Consolidated Food case, both of which are Seventh Circuit cases I cited in the brief, held that the failure to offer a correct instruction will excuse the trial judges giving an incorrect alternative, and the same principle should apply to the fail to offer any instruction. And on page 344 of the transcript, and this is colloquy between the court and the counsel, the judge says, and here I'm quoting, okay, I think it has been clear since yesterday that if I was going to aggregate the non-parties, every set I have given you has had the non-parties aggregated. If counsel wanted to preserve your record on that, you should have tendered one that had them set out separately. I mean, I don't think you got sandbagged on that one. You may feel differently, and I'll let you make a formal record about it. But, you know, I think, as I say, you've had a set of preliminary instructions since this time yesterday. They have cited absolutely no case that says a federal judge not only has to draft your instruction, but keep redrafting it until it's the way you like it, which is essentially his argument. It's our position that he has waived this issue, first of all, by failing to follow the pretrial order, failing to tender his own proposed instructions despite having more than adequate opportunity to do so, and also take a look at the objections. The grounds for his objection, he briefly mentions the statute, but the main reason he wanted those 11 parties set out individually was for the purpose of using the results in a case in which Great Western Express sued everybody else who was out there on the road that day for damage to their truck and their cargo, under the theory that everybody is supposed to get out of their way when they're speeding down an icy highway in blizzard conditions, including my client. He gave,
well,
and this is, I think...
That is a correct statement of Indiana law, is it not? people aren't supposed to stop on the highway.
You're not supposed
to get off to the shoulder.
If you can, but the shoulders and the road ahead were completely blocked. There was no place for my client to go. There was no place for the vehicles in front of her to go. And not only that, but the truckers who got stopped, Canon Express even warned drivers approaching that the road is completely blocked. Joe Mathis admitted to the guy driving the Canon Express truck that he knew and that he had gotten the CB transmission saying, I know the road is blocked. You drive your truck the way I want. I'll drive mine the way I want. They got 40% non-party fault discount, and they still argue that they should have gotten more. And based on what? What have they offered to this court to establish that they weren't at least 60% at fault in causing this accident? Or that the non-parties want more than 40%. It's nothing but pure speculation. But I think also another critical thing that the court needs to look at, the specific objection on page 373 of our appendix, and I'm going to read to you there. It talks here about, it's on page 374. Mr. Saffron says, Judge, for purposes of this trial and because of other pending litigation, I need separate lines. Either the court is going to grant my request for separate lines, or you have to do it in the aggregate. So the judge said, okay, I'll do it in the aggregate. And now they're coming in and they're appealing that. There's clear waiver here. If he wanted to preserve this issue for trial, what he should have done is tendered his own instructions. He says he doesn't know how to do it. Do courts have an obligation to draft paperwork for attorneys in cases such as this? So it would have taken 11 pages. If that's what he wanted, that's what he should have tendered to the court, and he didn't do it. So we have clear waiver, I believe, of that issue. There is federal law to talking about the issue of departing from the waiver rule in two instances, where there's a miscarriage of justice or plain error. Where is it here? Where does it say, anywhere that... that you could require the federal court to come up with multiple drafts of an instruction that you like without tendering or making any effort to tender your own instruction. They argue that the instruction was misleading. It misstated Indiana law. They had an opportunity to do something about it. The court offered to list the non-parties. He had an opportunity to tender his own instruction. There is waiver, and there is no miscarriage of justice or plain error here. Also, if you notice in their brief, they don't mention anywhere that they did get 40% fault discount and no punitive damages. There was a net judgment of slightly over $922,000 for the death of a 37-year-old woman who made $47,000 a year and left two daughters who depended on her totally. Where's the miscarriage of justice? Where does it say that if the road is completely blocked and there's nowhere to go, the shoulders and berm, what are you supposed to do? And there's a truck speeding behind you. I guess you end up dead, and that's exactly what happened to one of the parties here. We didn't cover the other issues with Mr. Saffron's argument. Did you want us to go into that about the directed verdict? Or also the other issue that he raised, which was about the ex parte communication? Since he did not address either of those.
That's up to you, ma'am.
Well, the director's verdict is...
in your brief, it's up to you.
It's in our brief. The issue is, of course, the federal reasonable person standard. In this case, there's overwhelming evidence. Keith Johnson was standing behind the car. Their expert admitted that their trailer struck the car and pushed it into the side of the moving van that resulted in these horrible injuries to this woman that caused her death. They admitted that their tractor struck the car that was in the left-hand lane. The trailer struck the car in the right-hand lane and also hit the tractor-trailer parked on the berm. How could it have missed the guy standing behind the car that was in the right-hand lane? How could reasonable persons not find, especially when you have two independent witnesses who saw that, well, one of them admitted he saw the Great Western truck crashing onto the scene, shoving everything out of the way that was there, and then he sees a man go flying through the air 40 feet off the ground, hit a tree, and land on the ground. Who else was it? No, we don't have eyewitnesses of that. You know why? They were running for their life, trying not to end up dead like this lady in the car. You also, there is a tremendous amount of physical evidence. Angela's paint from her car was found on the right side drive wheel of the tractor. Our paint is on the lower rail of the trailer as it rode along and shoved her under that moving van and killed her. Other witnesses saw Chief Johnson running out of the car, waving his arms, waving frantically, trying to get slow down traffic. He was trying to save her, and he couldn't. You have the United Van Lines driver who says he stopped on the berm and he hears bam, bam. He comes out and he sees the Great Western trailer collapse against his rig. You know, could reasonable person find that the man who's standing there between those vehicles also got hit by the same thing? Of course they could. Just lastly, I want to touch very briefly on the ex parte communication. First of all, there's no reversible error here. Federal case law does recognize an exception. You know, not all ex parte communications constitute reversible error. In this case, the driver of the Great Western tractor was divorced from his wife. And when they didn't call her as a witness, we wondered why. We hunted her up and found out that she had some things to say. She also told us, if he knows I'm coming, he'll kill me. He's threatened to do it before. You must promise me you will not let them know. There are numerous federal cases, usually involving racketeering type issues, in which the court says that it is perfectly okay to let the judge know who's coming and if there needs to be protections made on their behalf, and that's what we did in this case. But the only thing that they incurred was a slight delay in learning the identity of this witness. They argued she wasn't a rebuttal witness and the jury never even heard her testimony. How is that reversible error or even error, any error at all? I privately told the judge who she was because I didn't want her to get killed. Anyway, I think that my time is pretty close to up, so if the court has any questions. We believe we also did make a Rule 38 motion for an award of time because we think that this appeal is totally frivolous. There is just no grounds whatsoever. We think it's pretty clear that they completely waived the issue of the instruction that the court gave. They had an opportunity to tender their own instruction. They failed to do it. The grounds that they offered for objecting to the instructions were that they wanted to use the results in another proceeding. And with that, I'll be quiet.
Thank you. Thank you, Kylie. Counsel?
Your Honor, I want to address two issues and then go back to the main issue on the court's failure to tender a verdict form listing non-parties first and foremost.
Well, why didn't you present him with it? Because you didn't know how to do it?
Your Honor, I was a little concerned on the length of it, so the answer to your question
what?
Is yes.
So what?
I did not present a...
Why?
I didn't know how to do it, Your Honor.
Then do you think it's the judge's obligation to do it for you?
A verdict form? Yes, sir. Not
why did you take the case if you knew that you couldn't handle it?
I didn't say I couldn't handle it, Your Honor.
Well, you couldn't present the...
I presented jury instructions to that jury based upon the evidence of the case with the 11 non-parties. In all the years that I've been practicing, I've never had a case this complicated where 11 non-parties were named. Therefore, based upon that, I requested the court's assistance. If you look at the Indiana...
No, you asked them to do it. You didn't present any to them, did you?
The verdict forms are standard in the state of Indiana. I requested the court's assistance in how to list 11 non-parties. The statute,
you think that's part of his job?
I believe the statute in Indiana, because we're governed by the laws of the state of Indiana, that it is the court's job to render a verdict form. In all the cases
that
I've tried...
Not, however, the court's job in the federal system.
Your Honor?
Is not the court's job in the federal system.
But
the court's job is to pass on proposals made by the lawyers.
That's true, but it also follows the Indiana comparative fault statute.
It follows Indiana's substantive law.
That's correct.
But all matters of procedure are governed by federal court.
That is correct.
And there's no rule in federal courts that federal judges act as law clerks to the lawyers.
And do their work.
Well, I disagree. I've been in cases.
Well, I tender it. I think you can.
I could have tendered it. I did not.
Yeah. So do you have a case that says that a federal judge has to? I mean, that's your problem. I mean, there's no case that says a federal judge has to draft the verdict.
I have no case on point that a federal judge. Mm-hmm. I'm following the Indiana law that the court shall, if you file, look at the Scholes case, which is a recent Indiana decision, and the Dawson case about substantial rights affected. I believe that the failure of the court to tender a verdict form with the 11 non-parties.
We'll give you a week to present that case law to us, that a federal judge is obligated to do it. And supporting case law.
Or you can just concede now that your position is utterly unsupported.
I can't answer the question, Your Honor. I have no federal case that says a federal judge must.
Do you want a week to find it? We'll give you that week.
I don't know if it's there in a week, Your Honor.
I know it is. That's all right. But if you're so convinced that that's his obligation, that's based on your statement alone.
That's correct. In Indiana law. On the issue of the motion for directed verdict that was raised by the appellee, there was no evidence. The issue of my motion for directed verdict as to Keith Darnell Johnson was at the close of the plaintiff's case. There was no evidence presented by the plaintiff in her case that my client's vehicle ever came in contact with Keith Darnell Johnson. Therefore, we moved for a directed verdict in that case. That was denied. That was the second issue that we raised to this court. Court, have any further questions?
No.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you both. We will proceed to case number 6, please.